I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Azim Premji, the chairman of Wipro, one of India's leading technology companies. Wipro provides software solutions and research and development and information technology outsourcing to multinational corporations. Wipro's sales are over $3 billion, and the company was founded by Azim's father in 1946. Welcome.
Thank you.
Wipro is one of the leading technology companies, but the company today looks a lot different from the vegetable oil company that your dad started. And I'm wondering if you could please describe Wipro in the early days.
You know, we started in 1946 in a very small town in India, primarily crushing oil seeds. And then, you know, we set up manufacturing facilities to make shortening. My father died in 1966 at a very young age of 51. And I was a student at Stanford University at that time doing electrical engineering. So I had to come back in a rush and take over the family business. Very small business at that time. It was about $3 million a year.
Did you know growing up that you were eventually going to take over the business when
Not
he died?
Not necessarily, no. It was a surprise.
You went to college at Stanford. How did that happen?
Well, I did 2 years of college in India. And, you know, a group of us friends thought it would make a lot of sense if we could apply to American universities. And if we got into a good university, it would be worthwhile to do undergraduate studies there. I got to Stanford, and my parents were willing to finance me. So we just took off. And in those days, they only gave permission to go for engineering. You know, you were not permitted to go for anything outside of engineering because India needed good engineers. So I specialized in engineering. It was a wonderful 3 years which I spent there.
Where did you grow up in India?
In Mumbai, which is the erstwhile Bombay, the same city.
You find yourself in India, 21 mm-hmm. years old approximately. How did the employees take your coming on board?
People who were in the company in terms of leadership were extremely loyal to the family. And it was just natural that in a small company with high loyalty to the family, they would have expected somebody of the family to take over. So I was really not a threat. And, you know, I think a lot of my early success was because I got an enormous amount of very supportive coaching from them. Though my father didn't leave a very successful commercial company, he left a company with an enormous amount of reputation. Mm. Very, very high reputation, which was a major asset to build the future on.
And especially in a country like India, which has a reputation of being abundant in corruption to some degree, having a good ethical reputation perhaps set him apart.
You know, in the early days, there were some handicaps through it. There were some longer lead times involved. But our experience very soon was that high ethics was more of an asset. It got us more business than we lost. It got us better employees than we'd have got otherwise. It built employees with more muscle tone, more pride, mm-hmm. more self-respect. And it built a certain backbone and a character in the company, which has, I think, been our strongest assets going forward.
Now, you mentioned the company was started in 1946, mm-hmm. and India became independent in 47, and Pakistan was formed in 47. And you are Muslim, and a lot of Muslims left India and migrated to Pakistan. And a lot of Hindus left Pakistan, went to India. Did your family think about doing that at all?
No. And, you know, the leadership of Jinnah, who became the president or prime minister of Pakistan, knew my father well. So he was really trying to persuade him to come there as in a very senior ministerial position. But, you know, we had our roots in India, and we are very secular as a family. So we saw no reason why we should move from one country to another country just because it happened to be divided on religious lines. In fact, that was a lack of an asset to move to a country which was divided on religious lines because India was a very secular country.
Why do you think being in a secular country helps business?
I think there's more diversity. You know, I don't think you build a country on religion. You know, in terms of track record, I've been nowhere handicapped not being a Hindu in India. So it has proved to be right that we are truly a secular country. You know, which other country in the world today has a leader of the coalition who's a Catholic, Sonia Gandhi, has a president of India who's a Muslim, as a prime minister of the minority community of a Sikh, and has a leader of the opposition who is a Hindu. Mm. I mean, which other country can boast of that diversity in leadership and that diversity in a democracy? So it is not something which is superficial and we just thump our chest about. It's very fundamental to the economics of the country and the society of the country.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the billionaire and chairman of Wipro, Azim Premji. Wipro started off as a hydrogenated cooking fat company in the 1940s and has become one of India's largest technology firms. With over $3 billion in sales and 70,000 employees, Wipro was ranked among the top 100 global technology companies by Business Week magazine. Time magazine has listed Azim as one of the world's 100 most influential people. The company moves from a vegetable oil company to one that offers call center services many years later, and a lot happens in between. When did you first decide to start diversifying Wipro?
We first diversified Wipro in the end 70s. One reason was diversification was the style in those days. But more important, you know, we were looking for a high technology business, a business in the services area, because we believed that profitability and growth would be better in the services area, and a business where we could build a strong annuity revenue, you know, repeat revenue, recurring revenue. And we zeroed in on information technology. And one of the leading players in India, international, multinational computer company, had exited India in about 77 because of some revisions in the policy of the government of India. And they had very dominant market share in information technology. So it created a huge opportunity in terms of an entry point. And we started off addressing the domestic IT market.
Now, you mentioned in the 1970s, when you started focusing on technology, that Indian government policy changed. And they kicked out IBM. And I don't know if that's the company you were referring to, but it essentially closed the economy and did not allow foreign investment. When I think of that academically, it has a stigma attached to it when a government does that. Did you think at the time that it was unequivocally positive what the government did?
I don't think the government kicked out IBM. IBM kicked itself out.
How come?
Well, IBM, the government had a policy that they wanted IBM to bring current technology instead of selling computers in India, which they had junked in the rest of the world 10 and 15 years back. They were selling unit record machines in India in 1980. And I remember we started junking unit record machines at Stanford in the end 60s, scrapping them. I mean, they were based on cards, computer cards. You had to punch them in. They were semi-obsolete machines very early in the game. And two, the government said that you must dilute your stake in this particular area, which is of national importance. You cannot have a 100% company. And the government was still willing to give them majority control. And IBM in those days believed that the world could not exist without IBM. So they removed themselves from the country. And, you know, they tried to call the bluff of the government. The government was not bluffing. It proved an enormously wise decision for the government of India because it built up a whole local industry of information technology, which is today competing with the rest of the world. So, and IBM is back in the country with viciousness. They have today 48,000 people in India.
IBM is back in the country today because in 1991, the finance minister opened the country because there had been a balance of payment crisis where the reserves were almost zero, and it was sort of a wake-up call to India. But between 1977 and 91, Wipro was able to really develop its expertise.
And Wipro and many other companies.
People call you the father of Indian outsourcing. How did you come up with the idea to outsource your services? What was the catalyst for it?
You know, I think the catalyst was that we had built a very, very strong R&D team because in the late 80s and the early 80s, India was in a major foreign exchange crisis, you know, which necessitated the liberalization process which started in 90 and 91. And one had to really invent everything from scratch. One had to write the compilers. One had to write the operating systems. One could not import the software, you know, because the duties were either very, very high or the imports were not permitted. So you really had to build from a white sheet of paper a computer and solutions. And as the economy started to liberalize and imports became freer, we found that we could redeploy a lot of these people outside of pure R&D. So, you know, we used the expertise which we had built in the domestic market to be offered the same services in R&D services to global customers. And one of our earliest customers were companies like Nortel, companies like Motorola, companies like Intel.
This was in the late 1980s when fiber optic lines were not even put down between India and the United States. Yes. So how did you communicate with these American companies, for example?
Well, you communicated on telephone lines. They were not the high-speed lines and not as reliable as they were today. You communicated by making more frequent visits overseas. And it was not so easy.
I would love for you to define what Wipro is.
You know, we are a company which renders, we believe, world-class solutions for building productivity and results in companies, but which are embedded deeply into giving those solutions through the use of information technology.
So what does that mean?
If you want a sense of familiarity, we compete head-to-head with the IBM Global Services. We compete head-to-head with the Accentures. We compete head-to-head with the EDS. So we have specialization in finance. We have specialization in retail. We have specialization in manufacturing.
So, for example, my cell phone here sitting on the table, what role have you played in this handset?
We are one of the largest partners of Nokia globally. We design cell phones for Nokia. We design the telematics of cars. So if you see a General Motors car, or if you see a car of Nissan or BMW, part of the telematics of the car has been designed by us.
And when you say telematics, you mean, for instance, roadside assistance communications?
Absolutely.
Wipro still has the consumer business, and it accounts for 10% of sales, ultimately?
Totally about 7%, 8% of sales, yes.
Some people have advised you to spin off that part of the business because it would unleash some value. What is the reason why you're holding on to that? Is it at all sentimental because that's how your parents started it?
You know, that business has funded all our growth in terms of cash flows. So, of course, it is sentimental. And we're very successful. You know, it's a decent-sized business. We compete with all the multinationals successfully. We're not globalizing that business. Our focus is really the domestic India market. And it's growing at 30% a year. It's gaining market share, and it's fun.
What are some of the products you sell?
We sell toilet soap. We sell toiletries. We sell light sources, light bulbs.
So when I'm in India next week and I'm using toilet paper, it's most likely Wipro?
Toilet soap.
Toilet.
We don't make toilet paper.
Toilet soap.
Yes.
What does Wipro stand for?
Our original name was Western India Vegetable Products Limited, which became a bit of a joke when we went into IT. So we took the first letters of the name and dropped the V. And that's Wipro.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Azim Premji, the chairman of Wipro, one of India's leading technology companies. We'll hear more from Azim coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Azim Premji, the chairman of Wipro, one of India's leading technology companies. Wipro provides software solutions and research and development and information technology outsourcing to multinational corporations. Wipro's sales are over $3 billion, and the company was founded by Azim's father in 1946. Now, there are obviously skeptics in the United States towards outsourcing, saying that you are giving American jobs away. What is your reaction to them? What is your response to them?
The fundamental issue is that the United States is not producing enough engineers and not producing enough scientists. The United States will graduate this year probably about 70,000 engineers, when its requirement of engineers is probably at least 100,000, 120,000. And it's not a career of choice for young boys and young girls. And I think that's a fundamental problem that the country is facing. We find our attrition levels of our people here, because of demand from multinational IT companies, is so high that we have higher attrition rate in the United States than we have in India. This imbalance between supply and demand, we are giving solutions to American companies to be able to build technology. So we really work as co-partners. We do not see ourselves as outsourcers.
You talk about a scarcity of engineers in this country, but how about, for instance, the call centers in India? They're not engineers answering the phones. What is your answer to people skeptical of them who say we should have call centers here in the United States?
But do you have call centers in New York City?
We do not. Because labor is so high.
Because labor is so high. So your call centers are also migrating to your smaller towns because you're getting a cost arbitrage. So, you know, this is the dynamics of world competition. You know, I'm not saying that there is not going to be community sensitivity. There's probably much less community sensitivity on software engineers because they're not really getting displaced. They're just moving from one kind of job to a different kind of a job. So I think the more sensitive point, as you very rightly pointed out, is to call centers. What is the solution to that? You know, I think you have to appreciate that when companies and countries globalize, it is a two-way traffic. Sometimes it advantages, sometimes it disadvantages. And if the liberalized part of the Western world wants access to emerging country markets, there has to be some amount of quid pro quo attached to it. I mean, that's fundamental to the whole thing.
In fact, Thomas Friedman, in his book, The World is Flat, speaks to that. He says that economists often compare China's and India's entry into the global economy to the moment when the railroad lines crossing America finally connected New Mexico to California with its much larger population. When the railroad comes to town, noted Vivek Paul, who was Wipro's president, the first thing you see is extra capacity, and all the people in New Mexico say those people, those Californians, will wipe out all of our factories along the line. That will happen in some areas, and some companies along the line will go out of business. But then capital will get reallocated, and in the end, everyone along the line will benefit. Sure, there's fear, and that fear is good because that stimulates a willingness to change and explore and find more things to do better. So,
very well put. But, you know, you look at the IT industry in India and you walk into these large modern centers. What do you see? Carrier air conditioning. All the kids there are wearing Levi shoes or Adidas shoes. They're wearing Levi jeans. They are wearing all kinds of Western dresses. That's a product market for European and American companies. Probably about 60% of the incremental growth is coming from emerging countries. So net, there are cycles where, you know, it hurts. But then the fundamentals of economics creates jobs, including in developed countries.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Azim Premji, the chairman of Wipro. Wipro offers research and development, software solutions, and information technology or IT services to major automobile, credit card, media, retail, and mobile telecommunications companies worldwide. Azim has been called the father of outsourcing and India's Bill Gates. I want to talk about some of the cultural issues that Wipro faces, among them angry Americans who will call up and say, I don't want to speak to anybody with an accent. How are you training your Wipro employees to deal with American customers, for example?
We do very significant language training. We do very significant accent training. But today, even if you were to pick up a phone in the United States, I mean, there's so much diversity in culture in the United States. You can get all kinds of accents, including Mexican accents, Spanish accents, New York accents, Midwestern accents. You know, so what is an accent and what is not an accent anymore? I think at the end of the day, does the customer get a service he or she wants in terms of, you know, an end service or an end product?
Don't you think it's kind of sad that you offer accent classes?
Well, we do because, you know, otherwise there's a question of understanding on the other side, you know, because of accent infamiliarity. And what's wrong with that?
There's a little lack of cultural identity, perhaps.
But it's going to happen anyway. I mean, the influence of the West is getting so predominant in emerging countries.
We talk about American or Western influence on Indian culture. What can Americans learn from Indian culture?
You know, I think you're seeing it happening. You're seeing it happening in various parts of society. You're seeing it happening in terms of the importance of meditation, the importance of Indian music, particularly instrumental Indian music. You're seeing it happening in terms of yoga. You're seeing it happening in terms of some degree of family life also. I mean, so we bring certain strengths of more humane tolerance.
Do you do yoga?
No, I don't do yoga. It requires a lot of patience.
Do you have that patience?
No, I don't. But my wife has it. She does it very regularly for many, many years.
We talk about training employees, and you've mentioned a couple times that you try to train employees to be more self-confident.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that an issue with Indian employees?
Good question. I think one is to do with, they come from various cultures. And, you know, we also recruit not necessarily only from universities in large cities. We recruit from universities in smaller towns where the exposure to a more globalized environment has been much less, with the normal hesitation of uncertainty and fear. We believe that building self-confidence in people is a very strong prerequisite to building a culture of change. Because if people are self-confident, they're less threatened by change.
No doubt it's important, but it seems, is there something inherent in the Indian culture that necessitates this type of training in self-confidence? I don't think you would have that type of training with a group of American college grads, for example.
I think the society is more respectful of adults. Society is more respectful of authority. You know, we've been a country which was ruled by the British for many, many years. So, you know, it's a country where people are uncertain vis-a-vis how the Western nations are going to react to them on a one-to-one basis. But it is changing a lot. And now you see the community of Indian origin in the United States. It's probably having the highest per capita education, the highest per capita national income. And they're successful. You know, they're successful in engineering. They're successful in technology. They're successful in teaching. And they're successful in medicine.
You talk about, we're talking about self-confidence, and I want to go back to when you first took over the company. Did you have any issues with self-confidence taking over your dad's company?
Without question. I was petrified. I had no experience in business. It was a complex company in a complex market. It was very competitive. I was not trained for it. So one had to really bootstrap oneself and learn by trial and error in a very short period of time.
What's an example of a mistake you might have made early on with the business?
Mistakes on judging people and putting the wrong people in the wrong jobs and, you know, then facing a huge personal catharsis of changing them, which is not easy in Indian society, not because it's impossible, but because, you know, it's just not expected in terms of a higher fire culture. I would say those were the biggest mistakes one made in terms of not having a maturity of judgment on people.
I wonder, does anyone ever have a maturity of judgment on people, ultimately?
Well, you improve with experience and you improve with intuition.
We talk about the company in the early days, but I'm wondering what was challenging for Wipro, let's say, even in the 21st century. What has been more challenging for you than you might have expected?
Rapid growth. You know, we employ over 70,000 people. We are growing at above 30% a year in revenue. Ours is a highly people-intensive business. So even if you build more productivity and more automation year on year, you still recruit a very large complement of people to grow at 30% a year. Biggest challenge is how do you maintain that integrity of your culture? Because that's very important for delivering consistent, high-quality service to our customers. The second is how do you globalize? Because more than 75% of our revenue comes from global markets. Mm. And we are globalizing. We've done it successfully in Europe. We're trying to do it even more successfully now in the United States. So we are in the process of setting up centers in university towns, in, you know, the more rural settings of the United States, which are cheaper. And where there's local talent available in the universities, good local science and engineering talent, good ex-military personnel who retire early, but do not get jobs in that center. And they have family roots, you know, their families in farming, their families in trade, and they would like to live in those centers. You know, places like Georgia, places like Virginia. And what we are going to be rolling out shortly is hiring college students in large quantities. You know, we want to take each center up to 500,000 people. Take them to India for the 3 to 4 months induction training, which we do, full-time induction training, with all the engineers and scientists which we recruit from campus. Then keep them in India for another 3 months to get them familiar with the global models of operation and bring them back to the place we hired them from and build a cadre in the United States of young boys and young girls who really represent our future.
So it seems that instead of being an Indian company with a global outlook, you're a global company who happened to be based in India.
Absolutely. You know, we have, for instance, 3,500 people working in Europe. And out of those, 1,400 are locals. In Sweden, they're Swedish. In Finland, they're Finnish. In Norway, they're Norwegians. In the UK, they're English. And we've been able to do it very successfully there.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the billionaire and chairman of Wipro, Azeem Premji. Wipro started off as a hydrogenated cooking fat company in the 1940s and has become one of India's largest technology firms. With over $3 billion in sales and 70,000 employees, Wipro was ranked among the top 100 global technology companies by Business Week magazine. Time magazine has listed Azeem as one of the world's 100 most influential people. In addition to facing challenges in hiring people, especially at such a feverish pace, what about geopolitical challenges? I'm thinking about, for instance, in 2002 when nuclear war seemed imminent with Pakistan. What impact did that have on your business?
Well, a temporary setback because India got on travel advisory by American companies. So it became more difficult for people to travel because of security reasons. But, you know, I think the situation vis-a-vis our neighbors has stabilized now. And, you know, I'm on the advisory committee of our prime minister. And one of his key objectives is to build much stronger partnerships with all our neighboring countries, whether it be Pakistan, whether it be China, whether it be Burma, whether it be Nepal. Even our relationship with Pakistan is normalizing now.
You now have flights from Pakistan to India.
No, but we have issued more visas in the past 2 months for travel between Pakistan and India than we have issued in the past 20 years.
Well, in a way, India and Pakistan, for that matter, has more to lose now because of so much economic growth.
Absolutely.
So a company like Hewlett-Packard, if they're depending on you for their security and their back office services, if there is any strife, they're going to leave. How are you adjusting to that? Are you creating call centers, for instance, in other countries? Or
we have built a base in China now. We are in Shanghai, we are in Beijing. We have a base in Bucharest in Romania. We have a base in Porto in Portugal. We have a base in Brazil, in a smaller town in Brazil. So we are building also, we have a base in Mexico, a small one though. So we are building a global base in emerging countries to supplement our offerings from India. Because we also need to give that geographical risk mitigation to our customers.
I want to go back to the corruption question for a moment. There's an anecdote by, again, Vivek Pal, who's the former president of Wipro. When he was working in Bangalore, I believe for GE, he couldn't get a local telephone line from his office to the factory because he would have had to pay a bribe. So he somehow got connected to the fiber optic line and was able to leapfrog the local lines. But still, he was adamant about not paying that bribe.
Well, of course. You know, I mean, I don't think it's unique to India. It's unique to the United States also. It's unique to Europe also.
Yeah, so, you know, India has more of a reputation for that corruption.
I think because the needs are higher, because the bureaucracy is more deep, because the regulations were more frequent. I think what eliminates corruption or mitigates corruption is liberalization. And today we find Delhi is increasingly irrelevant to us. I just don't visit Delhi because most of the things we have to deal with have been deregulated, with the result that the necessity to be corrupt or the breaks or the barriers or the gates which bureaucracy can put on you has significantly reduced. I think our enforcement of laws is weaker. So it's not that we are more corrupt as a country, it's that people can get away with corruption easier. Whereas the laws in Western countries on anti-corruption and enforcements are stronger. So people are more afraid to be corrupt. So, you know, it's not something which you should just slap on to emerging countries like India and China. I'm not saying we are lily white, but you know, when a train runs on time, nobody worries about it. But when a train has a crash, you know, it's headlines in newspapers. Mm. And we are a democracy, and we have an extremely free press and a very, very speaking out press, which is a good thing in our country.
Your focus, your philanthropic focus these days is on primary education. Of all the issues facing India, why this focus of yours?
You know, the reason is that we have close to 400 million children below the age of 16 years, below the age of 14 years. We have 25 million of them out of school. We have huge dropout rates after Standard 5, particularly higher among the girls as compared to the boys. 90% plus, 95% plus of our primary education is with state government, which is of questionable standard. We believe it's a major transformation instrument in terms of intervention to build a cadre of more educated people who are better citizens of the country through primary education in the villages of India. So, you know, in our foundation, we focus only in the villages of India. In our company, we focus on the city towns. So we not only uplift the quality of learning and teaching, but it has a side effect. You know, the correlations between even a girl child who's educated up to standard 5 and 6, once she gets married, she has a smaller family. So indirectly, you've attacked the problem of family planning. Second thing which we again find is that a family which is little more educated, and I say little more educated, you know, you don't even have to be high school educated, is much more receptive to primary health care and interventions on primary health care and interventions on inoculations. So we see a tripod on it. Not only are we fundamentally educating people better, but I think we're contributing to, in an indirect way, but in a very significant way, to family planning and smaller families and more affordable families, and in some way to better environment for family health care. Because in education, we have to work with communities. We have to work with the father and the mother in a community to explain to him or her why she should keep the child in school, why she should not put the child into domestic labor, why she should not put the child on farm labor to supplement the father's requirements of farm labor in farm time.
What are some of your other hobbies or interests? What do you particularly enjoy doing?
I like hiking. I do it fairly regularly. And I take about 3-4 breaks a year. Not very long, but at least a week each or 5 days each. And I go up in the mountains. But I like to do it within, you know, a circuit of about a 6-hour drive from Bangalore. Because I don't like to ruin half my holiday in terms of commute. And it works well.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Jessica.
My guest has been Azim Premji, the chairman of Wipro. Coming up, we'll meet Jacqueline Novogratz, founder of the Acumen Fund, a nonprofit venture capital firm investing in projects that alleviate global poverty. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. My guest is Jacqueline Novogratz, the founder of the Acumen Fund, an organization that works to alleviate poverty in developing countries such as Tanzania, Pakistan, and India. The fund invests in entrepreneurs who are innovating new technologies and systems that provide clean water, affordable health care, and housing to low-income populations. Now, your approach to poverty is more market-based versus purely philanthropic. How did you go about discovering this approach? Have you always been an advocate of market-based solutions versus just giving water, for example?
I've always been an advocate of people making their own decisions. And I think that the best way to provide choice is through markets, because markets help us understand what people want and what people are willing to pay for. I also think that if we just give, I started a bakery in Rwanda 20 years ago. And when I first went into this bakery of 20 wonderful women, I noticed an electric stove in the corner. But the women were actually cooking outside on traditional wok-like instruments. And when I said, well, why isn't anybody using the stove? Well, it had been given to them as a gift by these wonderful nuns. But the cost of electricity was very, very high, and they didn't really know how to make anything that the stove used anyway. And so while it was a wonderful gift, it was a useless gift. And over time, in building the bakery together, I learned so much about what people actually wanted. And the women ended up quadrupling their own income level so that they were making 2 to 3 times that national average, because we started with something that people wanted rather than something that we thought people should have.
This notion of choice implies lack of humiliation. It seems like this world is rife with humiliated people lately. And if you give these people a sense of dignity and a sense that they are free agents choosing what they want, systems start to come together. One example that came to my mind of an organization that you support is A to Z, which is a Tanzanian malaria bed netting company. Could you please tell me about that, and what is an example of choice inherent in that manufacturing company?
Sure, it's actually a great example. This is as you said, the Tanzanian manufacturing company where we helped do a technology transfer to help the company start manufacturing long-lasting bed nets, which last for 5 years instead of the traditional ones on the marketplace that last from 6 months to a year before they're ripped and therefore ineffective. And so we've started a group of almost Tupperware-like lady salespeople who are selling these door-to-door. And what we learned is that whereas a public health official might say, you should buy or take this net and use it because it's good for you and your children, when you listen to these women sell, they say, first of all, you should buy this net because it will get rid of all the bugs in your house because there's this insecticide. Included in that is that your children, if they sleep near it, won't have lice in their heads in the morning, and so they will feel much happier. Third, you can sleep the whole night through. The children won't be as tired at school in the morning. Four, the colors are really beautiful. Fifth, people will know that you really care about your family. And finally, they won't get malaria and die. And so when you think about from their perspective how they're selling, it's from a, if it's from a perspective of dignity, beauty, comfort, status, and then health prevention, which are the same reasons we in the wealthy and privileged parts of the world make decisions. And so there's dignity inherent in the sales approach, and there's dignity inherent in the transaction, and we need to listen to that and build from that.
How would you describe the Acumen Fund?
We often say venture capital for the poor. We take small amounts of philanthropic capital, small amounts of philanthropic money, and we combine it with big doses of business acumen to help entrepreneurs build thriving businesses that serve poor people. The only critical piece that I would add is that it's specifically in the areas of health, water, housing, that these are basic needed goods for poor people to have productive lives.
I also think by putting it in the terms of house, water, and health, you're simplifying it for potential donors and for people who need to become educated about what you're doing. Because I find that a lot of these organizations, frankly like yours, are very difficult to understand by people like me living in New York or in America. And they don't really know the minutiae of what's going on in Tanzania or Kenya or Pakistan. How has it been for you to get your message across to potential donors, for example?
Jessica, it's a great question because you're absolutely right. The world is changing right now, and we've been approaching problems with an either-or proposition. So we want the markets to work, and so you can speak to me as a businessman, or we want charity to do good things, and so you can speak to me as a philanthropist. When you ask people to hold both in their hands, it can be quite complex and confusing for them. And yet, on the other hand, the kind of leadership we need in the world today has the ability to hold that balance of soft heart and hard head, or love and logic.
So what's an example of a company or a nonprofit organization that Acumen will fund?
Well, we just recently made a little bit more than $1 million investment in a for-profit company called Drishti in India. And the idea of Drishti is to build little telekiosks, so tiny computer centers at village level. To give you an idea of India, there are 600,000 villages in India. And so most of these villages don't have access again to the kind of information that's needed. So what Sachin Mishra, the entrepreneur, did was build a telekiosk unit that he will bring into a village, find an entrepreneur, lend money to that entrepreneur so that they can run it and then provide services that the entrepreneur will sell, like things that bring in a lot of money, which would be matrimonials looking for wives and girlfriends on the internet, horoscopes, what's called e-governance, driver's license, registering your livestock, and then things that people won't pay money for but that can be subsidized by the things people will pay money for, health and education. And what we learned over time was that not only is he moving, he's growing as quickly as Starbucks, but we realized that his best entrepreneurs are women, but women don't have access to the kind of money, $1,500, to build one of these kiosks. And so we then, as Acumen Fund, went to Nike Foundation and asked for $200,000 as a grant. We put that money into an account to get the bank ICICI, which is a big commercial bank in India, to give a line of credit to Drishti, which is now able to lend directly to women so that they can borrow money to build these kiosks. We have another organization that sells very, very low-cost eyeglasses to poor people, and this year we've helped them sell over 20,000. Well, this network of telekiosks is becoming a distribution system, not only for information, but now for product. And so we're experimenting with selling the glasses through that system.
So we're talking about now the current stage of Acumen Fund being a $20 million enterprise. But where did it all start?
Acumen Fund was started, officially incorporated in April of 2001. Like so many of these social enterprises, I think it's been evolving since probably 1986 when I first moved to Africa and had started a microfinance bank with women in Rwanda at the same time as this bakery.
How did you get to Africa in 1986? What led you to decide to go there in the first place?
I was working at Chase Manhattan Bank, primarily in Latin America, during the debt crisis of the early 80s, and saw how many low-income people were wanting access to credit but not able to obtain access to credit. What confused me then, and frankly confused me when I was 6 years old, it still confuses me, was why this very basic service wasn't available to all people. That we were writing off hundreds of millions of dollars that were made to very wealthy people that in some cases had no business plan whatsoever, when in fact the woman with the small business on the street corner couldn't get a loan to save her life. And so it was with that sense of passion and outrage that I decided I was going to see if we could extend the knowledge and the assets and access of a bank to poor people. I modified the Chase training program and taught illiterate Rwandan women what supply and demand meant, how to do bookkeeping and cash in, cash out, things that were really not that much more complicated.
Now, you mentioned that you had this question at six. How does a six-year-old have questions about this need for some type of market mechanism to fix the world?
Well, I'm not so sure I was thinking market mechanisms. But when I was six, my dad was in Vietnam, so I saw pictures of and he would write home about the children. And I went to a Catholic school, which helps in terms of raising questions of social justice almost every day. And so we would talk about it in the classroom. The seminal beginning of understanding the power of markets really came from Chase in my 20s. I don't think people are standing on street corners asking for handouts by the billions. And what we're talking about is 4 billion people who are left out of the really thriving part of the global economy. What I think is that they're saying, just give me an opportunity to do what you do.
By the way, you mentioned Catholic school, so I'll just give you a little piece of Judaism, which is the greatest gift you could give somebody in Judaism is a job, because it's not charity. You're giving them the ability to better their life as well.
But it's the same. It's the same idea. Just give me a chance to be me.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jacqueline Novogratz, the founder of the Acumen Fund, an organization that provides venture capital to entrepreneurs in developing countries. Where, by the way, did you grow up?
All over. My dad was in the military, so we were, you know, seven kids being caravanned around.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Virginia undergraduate and Stanford for business school.
You went to Stanford Business School because you thought you wanted to be in the business world?
Or? No, I went after I had done the banking, the Rwandan bank. They called me Ms. China Kadogo in Africa, which means little girl. And so even though, frankly, we'd built the biggest lending institution for the poor in the country, I was still a little girl. And so I thought a few letters after my name wouldn't hurt.
So how did you come to build the largest microfinance organization?
Well, I came in and did the feasibility study, saw that it was possible, worked like a lunatic, helping a small group of women, five of them really, put a bank in place. And so by the time I left 2.5 years later, a lot had happened. Family code had changed. Women could open bank accounts on their own merits so that women were getting access way beyond the organization. There's a complex and tragic piece in it as well, in that during the genocide, The women played out every conceivable role, from being killed on the first day to being victims and watching their families get killed to being a major perpetrator. And what I learned through that was the importance of building institutions and not just betting on a charismatic leader. And so after the war, and I take zero credit, I had nothing to do with this, the institution became the largest rehabilitation lender in the country.
How old were you at the time?
Between 25 and 28.
Were you at all lonely ever at times? Because being in Africa, not speaking the language, is tough for anybody.
I think, though, whenever you're building something new, whether it's in your hometown or across the world, there are very lonely moments. That's just a part of the deal. A lot of people think you're crazy, or they think you're too little, or they think you're too something. You're too two. I think you can be in a crowded room of people, all of whom you know very well, and still feel that loneliness. I have the kind of personality that you could put in an airport anywhere, and I will probably not be lonely within a few minutes. So that's not the problem.
And how was it going from a place like Rwanda to Stanford Business School, which is really the apogee of luxury and academic acumen? Was it an easy transition?
Well, I once told my mother in a letter around then that I felt like I had moved from this wild, wonderful Technicolor dream into a box of Wonder Bread. But that soon fell apart. So when I first moved to Palo Alto and to Stanford, it was a bit of a shock. I wore all these big, colorful dresses and lots of jewelry, and I missed walking down the streets and seeing women with bunches of bananas on their head and the mist and the smells and the flowers. It was nice to be in a place, though, where people showed up on time to meetings and things worked. And when you said you wanted to do something, it got done right away. And so it was a mix of loss and renewal. I think for me, part of the beauty and the wonder of life is having that openness and that flexibility to be able to dance all the way across it all.
So now you're at a point where you have support from Google and from the Gates Foundation, and you're really building a tour de force. But what about in the very early days when you were getting Acumen off the ground? What was harder for you than you thought it would be?
Everything was harder for me than I thought it would be. Probably the hardest thing of all, which was shocking to me, was that I thought it would be really easy to find these hybrid enterprises, that there would be lots of really great either nonprofit or for-profit entities in the developing world, which not only were delivering health and water and housing to poor people, but were doing it in a way that could potentially, at one point, believe they could reach at least 1 million people, and that, in fact, we couldn't find them. We looked at 700 different organizations to find our first two enterprises. And when you've got a team of three, that's a lot of enterprises to be looking at.
Do you believe that you are going to pay back your investors?
Well, that's a really important and great question, and shows how complex the language is that we choose to use. Our investors don't get any money back. We call them investors proactively and deliberately because we use the same level of rigor both in working with the organizations with which we work, as well as measuring the impact and the returns that we get to Acumen Fund. But any financial returns we get, and this year we'll get about $800,000 back to Acumen Fund, we move back out into the field.
Do you ever feel that your personal security is compromised? For instance, I read in your annual report that you were in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, and you were surrounded by bombs.
I don't feel that I've been personally at risk. I'm very careful. In places like Pakistan, we have a wonderful community of people who help me be smarter about the way that I interact. And I believe that our work is really fundamentally at bottom about helping to create a world that has greater personal security.
Now that you're getting older and you're no longer a 25-year-old hanging out in Rwanda and traveling the world, and you spend 60% of your time on the road, are you tired of this? Does your body take a toll, or are you as invigorated as you've always been about this? And by the way, you're not old. You're older.
I hear you, Jessica. I hear you. You can call me old. I honestly, my body definitely gets tired at times. I wouldn't say it gets tired. It gets a little creaky sometimes. The difference between then and now is then it was an adventure. It was an extraordinary adventure. I think I finally understand that I don't have a career anymore, that it's really become a mission in my life. And I'm probably never more invigorated than when I'm in the field working with people like Tasneem Siddiqui in the slums of Karachi who are building housing, or Lisa Kimbo, who is building a health franchise for women in Kenya. They are the tireless ones. They are the ones that are risking everything and making big, big, big personal payments to build systems that are filled with dignity and hope, but are also tough and focused and hopefully profitable at the end of the day.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Jacqueline Novogratz, founder of the Acumen Fund. If you'd like to listen to the show online, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com. If you have questions about the show or an endeavor you're trying to get off the ground, please email us at talk@fromscratchradio.com. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.